This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Janice Josephine Carney. Today's date is the 6th of June, 2005. I'm on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building, and Janice is on the telephone at her home in Florida. Good afternoon again, Janice.
Good afternoon.
And thanks for your time. If you don't mind, Janice, I'd like to ask a couple of questions that pick up just about where we left off on our previous session, and that was covering the time period of your arrival in Vietnam. But before you actually arrived there, you had been describing a number of events in the training experiences that you had, and I wanted to kind of put alongside those a timeline question that will maybe help people get a good sense of the time period when you actually were finishing your training and moving out to Southeast Asia. The question that I have is whether you actually recall your feelings when you learned about the United States deployment of forces into Cambodia, or the immediately subsequent shootings at Kent State University. Do you remember that, Janice?
Oh, yeah, really, because it all... That stuff all happened while I was going through my training.
Yeah, and I remember you said that there were some protests, that you had actually attended a peace rally, and then you signed the petition. Was that all part of the reaction to Kent State and so on in Cambodia, or was it?
It was a reaction to Kent State.
Okay.
It's a huge distinction. When you're talking about Kent State and Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I was 100% against Kent State, but
sure.
The feelings on Cambodia were kind of mixed. I mean, I felt I was in the service at the time,
mm-hmm.
and obviously I felt, well, if we're going to fight the war, we have to go into Cambodia
for tactical reasons.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for several years, I mean, I was aware of this, and even more going to basic training by this time. And when that happened, I was actually going to my AIT
mm-hmm.
with the medical training in Texas. And, you know, I know chances was really, 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 extremely, really good that I was going to be in Vietnam within a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of finally going into Cambodia to cut down the supply lines, it was either doing that or leaving Vietnam. One or the other. If you follow, you know my thinking.
Sure.
It was either a decision was going to be made to finally go in, destroy, and fight the war, or leave.
And so, if I can just pursue that piece for a minute, your thinking at the time was that this was, if we were going to fight the war, that President Nixon made a good decision then.
Yes, if he totally.
I mean, we were committed to fighting the war, and. And he wanted to make sure that the safe havens for communist insurgents inside Cambodia were not being used to hurt American troops.
Right, right. I mean, it was no question from the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which runs that long layout in Cambodia.
Sure.
From day one of the war, this is how all the supplies and the NVA troops were coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And the absurdity of, South Vietnamese Army and the United States Army, chasing the enemy to the border, and then once they got across the border, we stopping and saying, well, we got principles, we can't cross this line. And, the NVA on the other side of the line laughing their asses off,
right.
Saying, boy, aren't Americans stupid. I mean, that's the, I've equated it a number of times to the Normandy invasion.
How so?
If we fought World War II the way we fought Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
we never would have invaded France, because France was a neutral country. Just because Germany invaded France didn't give us a right to. It's the same logic.
Mm-hmm.
Exact same logic. That's the logic we were using. Just because the NVA went into Cambodia, that doesn't mean we are.
Right.
It's the exact same logic.
And then, I mean, your emotions then must have somersaulted when you saw what happened in Ohio.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Ohio was more of, you know, we should just leave totally. That we are just so out of control. What were you know, guardsmen doing on a campus? With loaded M16.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, I've learned a lot of this stuff in hindsight for me. Because
mm-hmm.
you know, altogether, I put 13 years in the military, counting all my reserve time.
Mm-hmm.
For psychological reasons, I stayed in the reserves and guards.
Okay.
You know, I wanted to be ready in case we went back to Vietnam. I had some serious issues. But I...
You personally wanted to be ready, or you wanted the United States to be
ready? I wanted to be ready.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... After the fall of Saigon, I had a hard time dealing with the concept of that we just deserted to self-Vietnamese people.
Okay.
I mean, I had a lot of just really mixed feelings
mm-hmm.
that, you know, don't make sense, I think, to a lot of... Don't make sense to me, don't know a lot of people. But the... When I got out of the regular service, I completed my 6 years of the 3 years inactive.
Mm-hmm.
I got called up a couple of times. The snow emergencies, the blizzard of Sydney. I was actually activated when the Pope came to Boston.
Oh, yeah?
Part of an honor guard.
Wow.
That was interesting.
What year was that?
Oh, wow. 78, I think.
Okay, I'll ask you about that later.
But the,
sounds interesting.
And, I'm trying to think, when the busing, the riots in Boston,
mm-hmm.
was my connection to riot training.
Okay.
Because we, I got activated as an inactive reservist, and we had a bunch of riot training, and we were stationed outside of Boston in Reading, which is a suburb of Boston, which is a big Massachusetts National Guard training center.
Yeah.
And we issued the full riot gear, which is the big shields and the riot sticks and all that. And they had all this riot training. And it really looked like it was going to get extremely ugly
mm-hmm.
At the time. This is when they just first started the busing.
Yeah, I remember it. Boston was the worst place in the country.
Well, it was. And I'm Boston Irish. And,
mm-hmm.
and I knew these people. And... it was like I was going out to fight against my brothers,
mm-hmm.
sisters. Because the Boston Irish, sadly, were the dumbest, most prejudiced people. The protection of South Boston, and, you know, we don't want no...
That's right.
...was an art, but I'm trying to stay focused. But the
okay.
But the training we had and the equipment that we were going out with was riot. We had tear gas, we had shields, we had the batons. We were not... issue, you know, M16s and ammunition. This is America. You're going out, and this is what went wrong at Kent State. And I believe they never made that mistake again, that the National Guard, I think in all state levels,
mm-hmm.
never, ever, again, sent out reserve, you know, guard units for riot control with
mm-hmm.
loaded, you know, loaded
mm-hmm.
weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They issued riot gear.
Did you, when you were going through that training and when they were parceling out the material and equipment that you would have to use if you were actually in that situation, did you ever think back about Kent State and...
Oh, yeah, I did 100% because I asked questions about it, you know, about the policy and stuff.
Did you?
Yeah, that's pretty much what we were told, that after Kent State, that was it. They were the really, really top levels. It came down that... In whatever studies were done or whatever reports,
mm-hmm.
that was a mistake. I mean, mm-hmm. you go, especially in a college campus, where the worst that you're going to get at the time was maybe have some rocks thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason in the world for them to have had, you know, gone to like they were going to war. Tempers rise, they flare, and at that time, there really was this huge, huge build. I mean, the military. And the anti-war protests had been building up and building up. by 1970.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it was this us against them mentality.
Mm-hmm.
But the situation on a college campus with really, I mean, as far as I know, they'd never have been any college riots during, or protests during the Vietnam era that involved protesters using weapons. You're outside of, you know, rocks and stuff that you could have protected with even riot gear at the, you know, that they had at the time.
Right.
It was like just a huge unequivocal era to put their troops in that situation with loaded weapons, loaded 45s and loaded M16s.
Yeah, it's shocking. It's just a shocking incident, and it must certainly have felt that way at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I can. I have no way of knowing how I would have acted if I was in that situation. I mean, I spent 366 days in Vietnam, and I never fired a single shot. But if I was on a college campus and I had a load of 45,
mm-hmm.
and I had an angry mob throwing rocks at me,
right.
I may have been teed off enough to fire around. I don't know.
Let me ask then about your actually going out to Vietnam. Last time we left it, you had had a home leave just before deployment. And then, Janice, if you can, just retrace your path overseas.
Well, from the time I got my orders at Fort Polk?
Yes.
I think I had about two days. From the time I got my orders at Fort Polk and you got a flight back up to Boston.
Okay.
And I was just dealing with the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember what I had. It probably was a 30-day leave. I think that's what they gave you.
Mm-hmm.
It was either a 30 or 14. I honestly don't even remember, you know, the amount of days.
Where did you went to Boston?
Right.
Well, where did you go? Did you go?
Well, I flew. I think it was Lake Charles or something to New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
and then to New Orleans Logan Airport,
mm-hmm.
in Boston.
Did you spend time with anybody in the family? Or
a little, mostly with my brother David, who had just got back from Germany.
Yeah.
He and I talked a lot.
He wanted to go to Vietnam.
Yeah,
right?
He wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But, but my father never said much, from what I can remember. He was just really,
mm-hmm.
for him, really, really quiet,
mm-hmm.
and introverted. Mm-hmm. From the discussions we had when I decided to join the Army.
Right.
From how adamant he was about me, going into the military.
And now he was very quiet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I was home and actually had orders to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And he, it was, I don't know, I think it was kind of a shock. I think both of my parents see me, with that typical military haircut,
mm-hmm.
and in the uniform.
Yeah.
It just, wasn't there flamboyant little son.
Mm-hmm. and did your father make any effort to, I don't know, meet you halfway, tell you you'd done good or wish you well or any of that, or was he just shut down?
He was just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still there?
Yes.
Sorry, I just had to call waiting thing. If it doesn't go away in a minute, I'll...
Okay, we can take a break if you want to.
Can you sit there for 1 second?
Sure. So Janice, you were telling about getting ready to leave Boston for Vietnam, and what was kind of going on in the family. But you said you were talking to your brother David.
He was just the most adamant and worried about me. But he wanted to go, and he was always just he was just kind of, you know, tough. He was a tough one. Who was, you know, that could fight, and he was the one that was always standing up for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he knew that, you know, that I had this thing for wearing my sister's clothes.
Right.
And that I was, you know, that I'd never want to fight in my life. And it was just, and he was just trying to give me more pointers and, you know, and stuff. I could just tell he really was concerned. That, you know.
He sort of took up for you.
Yeah.
And he wanted to do what he could to keep you safe. Is that?
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah. And
what was he was in communications?
Yeah, he ended up doing all his time in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and he was he had kryptonite code, something like that I think they called it,
mm-hmm.
which was it was like a top secret, and I guess it involved a lot of training.
Okay,
and the particular MOS he was at the time. He was needed in Germany, and he wouldn't let him transfer out of he wanted to, he had actually put in a transfer to want to go to Vietnam.
But he was too valuable where he was.
Yeah, yeah. They wanted to keep him.
How long did he stay in the Army?
He served 2 years, all of it in Germany.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And he had just got home not too long from the time that I came back from my training.
And was that the end of his 3 years?
Yeah.
Did he consider extending his active service?
No.
Okay.
No, he wasn't that.
he wasn't that far gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a realistic story. So.
What path did you take over to Vietnam? Do you remember? Did you go through California or?
Yeah, the El Presidio,
mm-hmm.
in San Francisco. It ended up with I went to the airport. I took the Boston subway to Logan Airport with a friend of mine that I went to high school with.
Yeah,
and nobody from my family were with me. I really don't remember why, honestly. You know, if you all were too busy or what, I don't remember the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just me and this friend, and we just kind of, you know, joked a little bit, but mostly it was quiet. And so that was it. He just kind of, you know, wished me good luck when, you know, I went through and it was just this very, from that point on, just this very quiet, lonely, you know, there's no other way to describe it. You're sitting on a plane, you're flying from Boston to San Francisco with a, you know, the Army uniform on.
Mm-hmm.
I think both people on the plane kind of figured out where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yet, no, you know, it was still, even at that point, there was just nobody, nobody wanted to make eye contact with you or talk to you.
Nobody came up, sort of, you know, hit you on the shoulder and said good luck or.
No, even at that level, it was just kind of like.
Wow.
Yeah. They were, you know, they're afraid it might catch something.
Mm-hmm. Had that pariah thing.
Yeah.
Wow. How were you inside? Can I ask, were you anxious? Were you resigned? Somewhere in between, both.
Yeah, just somewhere in the middle. You know, a lot of fear and still contemplating deserting. To be honest with you, I mean, you know, I in 1970 to finally get to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, I wanted to go down to hit Ashbury, put a flower in my hair, and disappear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still had that fantasy.
Really?
Yeah. Right, you know, right to the bitter end.
Wow.
And the, and that's, you know, why, you know, I ended up staying in San Francisco one night, and I, technically I was one day AWOL. You know, when I reported to the Presidio.
Mm-hmm.
And, and, at which, you know, that still kind of pisses me off. That the, because I was, you know, 24 hours later reporting in.
Right.
They gave me an Article 16. They gave me a fine and took my stripe away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I only had, you know, it was a private.
Right.
Then they busted me and gave me a fine.
What? How much was the fine?
I don't remember because the pay was so small.
what
you played a private back then. The month was cut. It was ridiculous.
And what did you do for that day when you were supposed to be on the way over there? What did you actually do? Do you remember?
Well, I wandered around San Francisco.
Just kind of walking the streets?
Yeah. And
thinking?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really was giving, you know, serious consideration to, you know, deserting.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a plan as to what you would, how you would actually do it?
Just throw the uniform away. That's about it.
Okay.
Yeah. There were enough, I mean, San Francisco.
Yeah.
In 1970, I could have gone up to just about anybody and said, look,
yeah.
I got orders from Vietnam, I'm not going, can you help me? That, you know, I would have had a small army saying, yeah. Have some food, have something to eat, come on to my place.
I'm sure you're right. do you even know now, or can you say what decided you on what you should do?
Probably John F. Kennedy. I mean, it was a part of me, I think, that really bought into, you know, that's not what you can do for your country, that's what you can do for your country. And I said, I messed that up.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I think you came through.
Yeah, I got to get that right. there was just this part of me, I think, that believed that it was the right thing to do, that we were stopping communism, and we were trying to promote democracy and the Republic of South Vietnam. I think that is what really, more than anything, kind of. And it didn't it didn't take me very long to be in Vietnam to realize, well, that was wrong.
that it was what, a fantasy?
Yeah, the whole concept of, you know, democracy in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
They were just, I learned fast. There was just so much corruption. It was, you know, a puppet government. The majority of the South Vietnamese people, all they wanted was the foreigners out. And even at that time, before, you know, I had very little knowledge of the whole colonial thing,
right? Mm-hmm.
And the French influence. That after being in country for a while, especially being up in, you know, up north in Way.
Yeah.
And you know, driving through the cathedral and really getting this sense of what, you know, France had done to the culture in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That, and they did not, you know, in the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese for that matter, but neither one of them wanted an outside country to come in and dominate them militarily and force influence on them. I think they wanted a democracy, but it was never going to work by us being a military force. You know, if that makes sense or not.
Do you remember a particular incident or observation that you made when you arrived there? You said you got this pretty clearly soon after you got there.
When we arrived in Tong Son Nhut,
uh-huh.
We were rushing to the buses. It took us to the training center, or whatever it would be called.
Mm-hmm.
And the buses all had mashnets to protect the window.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a driver. Somebody said that, they said that's to protect you from throwing rocks at us. And it was just like almost automatically. It was kind of like this thing, you really don't really want us here. They're not exactly welcoming us with open arms.
Right. In fact, you're in danger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is from the people we're supposedly protecting. That was a message, from day one in country.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned corruption, too. Did you see that? Or did you hear about things that...
Well, from what I saw and knew with supply disappearing, and I saw the same thing over Germany,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of supplies from the missile disappearing,
mm-hmm.
meals are leftovers substituting for what was supposed to have been a steak meal for 1,500 people. They're kind of disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of that kind of stuff in Vietnam. How stuff in the PXs and different things were ending up on the black market. Even in the... and just the way certain officers lived, very... with air conditioning, especially in Saigon and all that.
Sure, mm-hmm.
And to me, this is what I label as part of the corruption.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And with a lot of the illicit men, living in, just hoochers with no air conditioning, there was a huge class thing between the officers and the illicit men. It was nothing like what I know from World War II, even Korea,
mm-hmm.
where the officers actually led, actually led the charge, but phoned it in,
mm-hmm.
from a few miles in the rear.
From the air-conditioned comfort of the...
Yeah. We're right behind you.
And what would you say morale generally was like when you first arrived? I know you went up to the... you went up near Fubai, is that right?
Yeah.
For the first week or so.
Yeah, well, what happened, I arrived at Tonsonut, which seemed much happier and safer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was big and just well-rounded. And from there, I was sent up to Da Nang.
Okay.
And Da Nang, too, seemed a certain more, it seemed more open and more was going on, as far as fighting a war.
Okay.
Yeah, but the same thing, I was only there for one or two nights. I'm not sure if it was two nights. I think it was two nights.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I was... At that time, my training had consisted of the field medic training and the clerk typist training.
Mm-hmm.
That was the sole training I had, the general clerk and the field medic. And I thought all along they were either going to assign me as a field medic or some kind of clerk. And in Da Nang, they assigned me to 101st Airborne, the 39th Transportation Battalion, to one of their line companies. I was assigned to 666 Transportation Company to drive deuce and a half and three-quarter-ton trucks.
And, of course, you'd never even sat at the wheel.
Yeah.
Right?
Never drove, never had a driver's license, never had any training.
Right.
And I was just, and that's what I was really petrified of, people doing.
I mean, what message did that send to you?
That was the ultimate message, that these people just do not know what the hell they're doing. I mean, I'm laughing, but it was.
Scary.
I mean, I'm sitting talking to the sergeant,
mm-hmm.
and he just sits behind, pulls out the regulation, and looked up, 70, I think it was 71B, what the clerk type is,
mm-hmm.
and just goes across 71B, clerk type is, regulation says you can drive, it's your problem. Get out of here. With a few swear words.
Wow.
And that was it. His attitude was take it up with your top when you get up there. And I go out, like this big map. Everybody was racing out to this map, after they got their orders to see where they were going.
Yeah.
And You know, I'm looking up Kip Eagle and I'm saying, geez, that's kind of it's kind of a ways up there, ain't it? And, you know, the next day they put us on a plane, I don't know how many, eight or nine, maybe 10 of us. And they put us on this, I don't know what they call the planes, the prop planes with the two propellers. And all and all the seats were those net seats. It was basically the plane.
The transport.
Yeah, the transport, mm-hmm. and for jumping.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we still weren't issued any M16s. You didn't get issued a weapon, so you actually got to your unit.
Right.
So none of us are armed.
Right. Yeah.
And we're on this plane when that's really bouncing all over the place and sitting in these net things. And, you know, all the way up, the only thing I was hoping is that I didn't throw up.
I can believe it.
That, I came close a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And hoping I didn't throw up and you know, you're wondering, what the hell are we supposed to do if we get shot down? I mean, I'm not sure exactly what it was, a pilot or co-pilot. I don't know if there was any, I think there was one other person on the plane that was sitting in the back with us.
Mm-hmm.
So there may have been three, I imagine a pilot and a co-pilot had, they probably just had their sidearms, your handguns.
And that's it?
Yeah, if the other guy may have had an M16.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we were not even in great shape if for any reason we got shot down.
That's right. Sounds like it.
The absurdity of that, I never, and that was one of the first things in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been issued weapons right away. And this is a water telling us.
And they're flying you right in the middle of it.
Yeah. We should have been issued M16s and ammunition at the point in Da Nang. I mean, this is the way I was thinking.
So your first week, you've had the incident with seeing the mesh screens on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
You've been told that you're now going to drive a truck, which you've never seen before, and that it's your problem to sort out. And then you're on this plane ride with, you know, obviously over combat zones with no equipment that's appropriate to that. So were you actually taking all this in at the time, Janice? Were you really processing this?
I mean, like, it's tough. We talked the other mm-hmm. day about mm-hmm. Being, you know, an avid reader and kind of, I don't know if a deep thinker is a way of putting it, but...
Well, certainly, certainly an intellectual, no question about it.
I mean, I was processing a lot of this stuff and saying, this does not seem...
I mean, you're chuckling now, but I know this was probably extremely nerve-wracking at the time.
Right from the beginning, all this whole process of coming in country, it was like, well, this doesn't seem right. This is not logical. And when we landed in Fubai,
mm-hmm.
it was kind of the same thing that we were told. When they got close to the airport, they circled a couple of times. And we were told that they're going to keep the engine running. As soon as the plane lands, evacuate as quickly as possible. But they're opening up the back and they were going to unload some supplies real quick with like a forklift or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were just going to take right off.
And so the message there was also pretty clear.
Yeah, you know, they were worried about, you know, possible, you know, a rocket attack, you know, the plane being targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to just in and out as quickly as they could. And that's pretty much what they did. And the Fubai Airport was just a small old airport. There wasn't much going on.
Mm-hmm.
Small airport. And, you know, our duffel bags were just thrown out by the side. And, you know, we went out, you know, real quick, grabbed our duffel bags and went into their little, it was just really small, all wooden terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two people there. You know, we were just asked, you know, where we were assigned, and anybody going to the 39 trains to go over here, and there were, I think, three or four of us that were all assigned as truck drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we wait around for a while. Finally, this deuce and a half pulled up, then a couple of drivers. There were, you know. So the guy just jumped out and asked us if we were new truck drivers. And they said, yeah, and he just told us, get on board, and he just kind of laughing. Said, we need some more victims. We're getting killed. But he put something about we're losing them as fast as we're getting them in.
Great.
Made some comment like that.
Uh-huh.
and that was it. We drove up from Fubai, which is a short distance up to Camp Eagle,
uh-huh.
which is to this little village, and it was just...
What did the camp look like when you got there?
They looked kind of secure. It looked big, but it was nowhere as big as, you know, what I had seen in Tonsonut
mm-hmm.
and in Da Nang. There was a lot of space all around it. That I didn't know at that time, but obviously it had all been defotalized. Mm-hmm. Is that a word?
It had been cleared.
Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
And so you could see, you know, for I don't know how many miles, you know, anybody coming in case of a ground attack.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of hilly. And it was all just all these wooden hooches with these tin roofs on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was assigned to, they just dropped us off at my company, which the 666. I don't know if we all were assigned to that same company or not, but I just remember being dropped off there
mm-hmm.
and, you know, going into what was the, you know, company headquarters. And, you know, giving my orders to the clerk and, and explaining to the clerk that I don't know how to drive. And him just giving me this really dumbfounded look. Kind of going, huh?
Now, just to clarify, did you stay there very long?
I was assigned to the 666 for, about 3 days.
And did you get changed out of there because of action you took, or what happened?
The first sergeant was going to kill me, I think.
Because why? You didn't know how to drive a truck, or he didn't like the look of you, or what?
He didn't like the look of me. He mm-hmm. tried to drive a truck. The first night, I just reported in the office that he wasn't around, and he just assigned me to a barrack. And they assigned me to this barrack, and it was all these serious redneck, nothing-knock redneck people.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just all the country music playing and all these truck drivers, because it was a transportation unit.
Sure.
And the refrigerator full of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of beers, and somebody gave me some pills. I didn't know what they were. he obviously saw that I was very nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, take some of these, they'll help you sleep. And they were downwards, they weren't, you know, any uppers, they weren't speed, whatever they were. I just, after a couple of days, I just passed out.
Mm-hmm.
And all I remember was, you know, the next morning, somebody came in and woke me up saying the top wants to see me. And I got up and stepped on my glasses.
Ouch.
And so when I reported to the first sergeant, I had a pair of broken glasses, but when the lenses cracked.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And, you know, and he just totally went nuts on me. I had the necklace that my youngest sister made for me.
Uh-huh.
It with beads, and he just ripped that off my neck. And
no.
I said, what the fuck I was doing wearing that.
And when had she made that for you?
Before I left.
Uh-huh.
You know, a couple nights before I left for you now.
Uh-huh. And was it something you liked? Or
yeah, because I was always waving, you know, love beads and stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know.
So he got rid of that.
Yeah.
Did he give it back to you?
Oh, no, he just ripped it off. It was just like a string thing.
Yeah, and he just tore it off you.
Yeah, just pulled it off my neck and made some comments about, you know, being a faggot.
Being a faggot.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And,
good.
and just started, you know, screaming about what the shit about you don't know how to drive.
Mm-hmm.
That I better learn, you know, damn fast. And then, you know, when he saw my glasses, and he said, I had asked him about getting them fixed. He said, well, they got to send them to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And he just totally went ballistic on me. And he told me to go back to the barracks, shine my shoes, get a haircut. I mean, it was, I couldn't believe it. It was like basic training.
Wow.
I mean, I could not believe that he actually said, get a haircut, shine your shoes.
Right.
I spoke with Twitter, yo.
Right, in the middle of, right.
Yeah, I mean, I was put poke. I thought I was over.
Exactly.
And they did, and the next day I got a haircut, which was an experience. From the company, Baba.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his first name. Whitehead. His last name was Whitehead.
Mm-hmm.
And he used a straight razor.
Really?
Yeah, and I actually got to be good friends with him. I really liked the guy. He was quite a character.
Mm-hmm.
He would ask all the white guys while he was sharpening the straight razor.
Yeah.
How they felt about black women. The kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what answer he was looking for, but, you know.
Now, just to clarify, was he an African-American guy?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think he used to say something along the line that if you had a choice between, I think it was Kate Smith and Diane Cavill, who would you date? Something bizarre like that. Yeah. Like Diane Cavill, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, he occasionally would get these rednecks and say, Kate Smith ain't big no.
Right.
And he'd start, sharpening that straight razor and get them thinking. At the time, I learned that a lot of what was going on in Vietnam was there was a big moo-moo, was it moo-moo or mau-mau, I'm not sure how they pronounce it, which was a black radical organization.
Mm-hmm. The mau-mau.
Mau-mau,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And and this was at, you know, obviously 1970 after Martin Luther King's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the, you know, the black soldiers just felt it wasn't their war. That they considered themselves political prisoners.
Was he one who felt some of that too, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Really, really strongly.
Yeah.
That he was really, very political. And he, and that is going back to what I was saying, but a lot of the truck drivers in the transportation units, you know, were stereotypical, you know, hardcore rednecks from the, you know, from the South.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that had, you know, had, you know, the Confederate flags on their trucks and, mm-hmm. And, you know, it didn't take him long for a conversation with me from growing up in Boston and growing up in housing projects and I was used to being around black people. That was no big thing to me.
Right. He knew from that alone that you were different from most of the other guys there.
Yeah, we got a quick sense of mm-hmm. my experiences and even the music I liked and stuff.
You said you saw him and kind of, you know, bonded a little bit with him anyway.
Oh, yeah. I gravitated more. There was a huge separatist thing at the time. And I gravitated more to the black guys than the white guys. I mean, if you went to a hoot with a lot of black guys, that's where you were going to hear the Temptations and, but you know, all that kind of music I liked.
Mm-hmm. And how did most of the black guys take to you?
All right, I didn't have much of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was just. I don't know how to put it. It was just a sense of sincerity. And,
this didn't help with your popularity, I'm sure, among the truck drivers, the guys you're describing.
No, I did not get along with. I don't want to use the term hillbilly, but I will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just the whole different culture. I mean, in reality, I was more black than white by their standards.
So what was life like in the barracks for you then?
Oh, it was horrible. That's why I'm glad it only happened like two days. The third day, when I was supposed to start driving lessons. And by that time, they had sent out my glasses.
They had sent them out?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But literally, they had it to send to, I don't know, they could have had them done privately.
Right.
But they were Vietnamese, but they, I don't know, they had it to send them, because that's the way they do things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you could have just gone down to Fubai, because when I got around and learned what was going on,
yeah,
there were Vietnamese people there that sold glasses.
Sure,
they
sure.
could have fixed
of
them.
Of course, of course.
But the by regulation, had it to send them to San Francisco.
Now, Janice, can
lens,
I? Go ahead, go ahead.
So you know where the lens was replaced. It took a couple of weeks.
No, I'm going to, you don't have to say, but it might be interesting to know, were you nearsighted? Meaning you can see up close but not far away?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I was legally blind in one eye.
Right, I remember that, but your other eye?
Yeah, I couldn't, I couldn't read.
Okay.
I could see, I could see far away.
Okay.
But I couldn't read any signs or see.
This isn't going to be good for truck driving.
And the third day when he realized he, my understanding from the company clerk,
mm-hmm.
Is that the first sergeant, or the PO, I'm not sure which one, called the battalion commander, and he got into a huge argument that he was pissed, or what the hell they doing setting up these people that can't drive.
Right.
And that he needed, he didn't need another clerk, he needed a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they just transferred me to the battalion headquarters.
Which was where?
Well, it was on Camp Eagle, it was just actually,
just a different part.
Yeah, the battalion headquarters was kind of like in a center,
mm-hmm.
and the battalion was broken down into five or six companies. That were the support companies.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I mean the line companies.
So, of which the 666 would have been one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were broken down into one company had 5 ton trucks.
Mm-hmm.
Another one had deuce and a half. I did 2 deuce and a half and 2 5-ton companies, and another one that had 3/4 and jeeps. They were just kind of broken down like that.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever they were running convoys or how they would do it, they would all just be mixed in.
Was this then the 39th Battalion?
Yeah, the 39th Transportation Battalion.
Okay.
Which is the first logistical division. But that's the whole support unit of the 101st Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
The way it's broken down.
Right.
And so they reassigned me to battalion headquarters, and somebody from battalion headquarters was not too happy because apparently they took somebody that didn't know how to drive,
mm-hmm.
and assigned him to the 666 company to kind of appease their commander.
I mean, it sounds like a circus.
Yep. when you get your commanders calling each other assholes and screaming at each other and saying, who's running this? nobody seems to really know.
And your new assignment then was as a clerk?
Yeah, I was assigned to battalion headquarters,
mm-hmm.
Which is where under Lieutenant Colonel Elvin T. Ellis, who was affectionately known as Ace, which I always liked.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the few people that called him Ace. And he just kind of hated me from day one.
He hated you.
Yeah. You don't call a lieutenant colonel Ace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That didn't come out with too big, but I had an attitude problem.
Okay. And he was, what exactly was his position within
the
battalion?
He was the battalion commander.
Battalion commander of the 39th.
Yeah.
And was his last name, just for reference, E-L-L-I-S?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Okay.
Yeah. Elvin,
mm-hmm.
Elvin with E, Elvin.
Okay.
Elvin C-A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the first thing they assigned me as a filing cap, a filing clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, I don't know, for about a month. And it was interesting because I got to see, I got to play with all the files and get to read everybody's 214 at the headquarters,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which was I found out that I had the highest, I think it was a GT score. Do you have like an IQ thing that you take?
Yes.
I think it was called GT or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I had the highest score in the whole battalion headquarters company. I found that out, which was kind of funny. That kind of boosted my ego.
Mm-hmm. I bet it did.
And it, because he had wanted me to go into a West Point prep thing when I was in basic, but I wanted nothing to do with it. But did
you actually decline that then?
Was it
actually offered to you or just discussed or?
Oh, it was an opportunity because I took all these tests.
The tests, right?
Yeah. And the thing with it was, I had seriously considered it. Obviously, I'd rather be doing silly training than going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But the deal was, you go to the prep school for 2 years. But I don't know exactly where it is. But there is a West Point prep.
Mm-hmm.
And if you complete that, then you're committed to going to West Point for 4 years.
Right, and if you go there, then you're committed.
To doing 6 years of active duty afterwards.
Yeah.
Now, if you're 19 years old, that's a lot of math.
Yeah, that's a lot of commitments.
I mean, you're signing your life away, more or less.
And especially since you had you just weren't wired for interest.
I just wanted to do a 3 years and get out.
Right,
know.
Right.
But if I could have just done like a 2 year prep to kind of avoid, going to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and think about maybe by then, that's what I was kicking around in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, I just said no. But but all this stuff was in my ZD-214 that I had taken all these tests and was qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the run-in that I was constantly having with a commanding officer was more of an intellectual thing. Even being now, when I was reading a lot, I always had access to books.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost, it was kind of like a radar thing.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the way people kind of looked at me.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic job I had was all filing, keeping records up and making copies of stuff and and typing.
Right.
And I did that for about a month, and then they lost their battalion mail clerk.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly.
Unexpectedly?
Really unexpectedly.
Okay.
And they needed a replacement real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the Army, at the battalion mail clerk level,
mm-hmm.
you got to take the postal exam.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's another one of those strange regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to pass the standard postal exam.
So they had to find somebody who could pass it quickly?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're authorized to pick up mail for your battalion at the Army post office. And there was the people were going nuts because they should have been an executive officer. The way it works, you have an NCO who's your battalion mail clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposed to be the NCO. And then you have an executive officer. Those are the two people that are qualified. And you're supposed to always have those two. And he somehow, because I don't know how they screwed up without having an XO.
Mm-hmm.
So they had no lieutenant. And when I took it, I was a PFC. So they had to automatically give me another promotion.
Otherwise, you couldn't do the job.
Right.
Okay.
I had to fill a... They gave me a promotion of Spec 4,
okay.
Which is equivalent to corporal,
mm-hmm.
and put me in an E5 slot. And I took the exam. The exam was nothing.
Right.
So it was a piece of cake. And real quick, I got the qualification. And that's what I ended up doing the rest of my tour. I was a retired mail clerk.
Let me ask you just a couple of questions before we go on with that. And it's interesting, Janice, you mentioned that you always had access to books. Where did the books come from?
Oh, my brother would send them to me.
Mm-hmm.
My mother. Okay. When I can get down to, you know, we had a PX in Fubai. That's pretty good. I even had copies of the Rolling Stone all the time.
I was going to ask, what kinds of things were you reading?
I actually read Love Story when I was in Vietnam, which was really weird.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that the,
I think it was the biggest book of 1970 or something like
that. Yeah, that was all dealing with Boston, which is what I liked about it.
That's right.
It reminded me of home.
Uh-huh.
I actually read it about three times. It was really weird. What happened is, as a battalion mail clerk, I would be assigned a truck and a driver, a different driver every day, and I would be the shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
And where I was supposed to be, you know, lock and load it, and we were and paying attention, I'd be reading a book.
That's
just, you know, but Love Story is the main thing I'm reading. We used to have access to the Rolling Stone, which my commanding officer called a communist newspaper, and took it from my desk and tried to tell me that I couldn't read communist trash like that in his office.
But you got the next issue and continued to see it on a regular basis?
Yeah, I used to like reading it in front of him.
So was there some kind of, would you say, intellectual competition thing going on there? Or you mentioned Before Radar. Can you clarify that? What was actually, I mean, now that you think about it, what was going on there? Or can you
say? It was an intellectual thing, and it was a power struggle. Because he felt that I kind of had him. At the time, he had nobody else. He needed somebody, you know, with a decent education in the fill of the E5 spot. And believe me, nobody wanted to be the battalion mail clerk. You were driving every day to dangerous roads and back. It got worse. I'll talk, you know, when we moved up north. You had to get all this mail together from your six or seven companies, from the company mail clerks. You had to inspect their mail rooms and make sure they were following, you know, regulations. You had to do inventories for people, the truck drivers that were killed at all the line companies. You know, and pack their belongings and make sure that you got an officer to sign a letter. It ended up that they never got it, the lieutenant that I was supposed to have. They should have done a lot of that stuff.
So you just continued to do it?
Yeah. And he knew what I basically was filling a lieutenant slot in which should have been an E5 slot. And he didn't, he just didn't like my attitude, that I was disrespectful. I never saluted him.
And was that, why did you not do that? I mean, was it him or was it the situation?
It was him and it was the situation.
Mm-hmm.
They were running a lot of bike convoys where a lot of people were getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally opposed to it, that they could have ran a lot of these supplies during the daytime. And this is going back to a lot of the class stuff. A lot of these supplies that, you know, that they were, you know, pushing up to Quang Tri in these so-called priority night convoys,
mm-hmm.
with things like Bayer, air conditioners, not essential supplies for the PXs.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff that really was not, you know, a priority one, that they could have gone up in small convoys during the day, that wouldn't have been as dangerous.
How many guys were being lost? Do you have any clue? How many have passed?
You know, just about, if they were doing two or three night convoys a week, they would lose two or three drivers. Maybe a couple just to injury, but at least one that killed, or just about every convoy. They were getting ambushed every time going to the rock pile. And he, you know, had all these charts with statistics and saying, well, this ratio and this percentage, we're moving so much supplies, and it was, To me, it was insane.
It just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And day convoys would have had better chance.
Yes, you could have had a lot of these supplies. It would take you longer because
mm-hmm.
the road is being used.
Mm-hmm.
You're not running them up as quick, and you can't have big convoys. But they could have got a lot of supplies up that way. It would have been safer.
Dennis, let's stop there for a minute.